Okay. We are going to start looking at messianic expectations, but in order for you to understand the lens or the way we're approaching this, I need to kind of go through, at least the way I describe, levels of interpretation. And what do I mean by that? I'm not talking necessarily about like hermeneutics. Hopefully on hermeneutics, principles of interp, you guys go through this on some level. But there are multiple levels in a document. There are multiple levels of interpretation that are occurring simultaneously. So, like for example, especially when it comes to the Gospels. When it comes to the Gospels, you're really dealing with three levels of interpretation that you're going to be wrestling with on any given text. First level of interpretation is, when was it very first said? Not when it was very first received, when it was very first said. When did Jesus say those words? When Jesus says whatever words, you know, love your enemy, how was it received in around the 30s when he said that? You see that level? So it is this moment, okay? This moment right now that we are having. That's this first level. When I said this. Now there is a second level. There are three levels, but the second level is, when was it received, or the audience of the document? Okay? So right now, you all are receiving this information, and if I, for example, I say, I am giving you this information, and I am at the age of 34. When I first said that, that is true, that means something to you, it develops a context. But what about 3 years when this is up on the internet? The audience of the document then shifts. There is a different, because now they sit there and they think, yes, I'm receiving this when he was 34, but now I know it's been 3 or 4 years, therefore he is 38, and things have changed in the past 3 or 4 years. Does that make sense? So it's the difference of when Jesus first said, love your enemies or take up your cross, as opposed to when the document was received. So you're talking the 60s, whenever Rome is crushing the people. All right? So first level, when it was very first said. Second level, the audience of the document. And then you have, I don't really know if I like this term, but a modern reader, but I'm keeping it relative. In other words, the modern reader could have been the reader in the 1100s. It's the person that is reading the document in their given context at a later time than when it was first written or first received, or when it was very first delivered from the mouth of the person. Is this making sense? So whenever I look at a gospel text, I need to first think, how did the people sitting at the feet of Jesus hear this? How did the people in the 60s hear this? And how have the people since received this? Three different levels. Is that making sense? And this really goes, this is for any text. Any text, you have this happening. You have this occurring. What we are doing in this messianic expectations is we are focusing primarily on this one. Okay? That's very important. Why? Because there will be some things that I say here that actually I wouldn't agree with if we were here. Like, for example, I'll talk about Son of God. Son of God, when it was very first said in the Old Testament, when it was referencing the Son of God, it was a royal term. It's the way you refer to a king. It had no concept of this divinity, and that wasn't there. It was a royal term. However, I think it's more than appropriate to see divinity in that same phrase in this level of interpretation, looking back on Christ. Does that make sense? So that's why these are so important, because it's one of those things. It's kind of like whenever people ask me questions about American policy. And I'm sitting there going like, okay, it depends on which perspective you're asking me to answer from. A political one, a citizen's perspective, or even a Christian perspective. I would have different answers usually for each of them. Now, it really just depends on what is most valuable to you, because my primary answer will always be the Christian one. The Christian one for me trumps all the other answers. However, I understand that may not be the question you're asking me. You may not be asking me whether or not I think from a Christian perspective that this American policy is good or bad. You might be asking me, what do I think of it strategically? And strategically, it would be a different answer. Same thing whenever we're dealing with texts. Whenever it comes to Son of God, what does Son of God mean? Depends on which level we're at in the interpretive move. Son of God here means king. Son of God here, referring to the same text, even from the Old Testament, through the lens of Christ, can mean divine, divinity. Does that make sense? Just depends on which layer I'm looking at. We are hanging out here for this messianic expectation discussion. So I will say things here that I may not even ultimately through Christ agree with. Does that make sense? You follow me? Okay? All right. Okay. With that in mind, everybody have their handout, hopefully. With that in mind, I want to begin by dispelling four myths. Four myths of whenever we start talking or we start to talk about messianic expectations or what was assumed about the Messiah. There are four major myths I want to say at the very beginning, and then what we will do, so in other words, when I'm starting here at the beginning, is I'm deconstructing, I'm sweeping the floor, and then we will construct. Okay? Sweeping away the expectations. Myth number one, the majority of the Old Testament texts point to a messianic figure. Remember what level I'm referring to. This level. Level number one. And the reality is, that's not true from this perspective. That the majority of the Old Testament texts are pointing to a messianic figure. From a first level of interpretation perspective, that's not true. They weren't talking about a Messiah. I mean, usually, I mean, even the word Messiah in the Hebrew, when it is used, it's not used to refer to the single one that would be the Christ that would deliver them from their sins or even deliver them politically. I mean, the word Messiah is used at times for inanimate objects, like altars or cultic items. It's used for the king of Israel, the anointed one. It's used at times for priests. It's used for prophets. It's used even for the entire people of Israel. It's even used for Cyrus the Persian. We know about him now, yeah? He's referred to as the Messiah, or the anointed one, the same Hebrew word. An enigmatic figure is referred to as the anointed one in Daniel chapter 9. So in other words, the word Messiah, it's not as if it is not found in the Old Testament, but from the first level perspective, to dump everything that Jesus was into those from the first level perspective is putting too much on those texts when they were originally written. They weren't envisioning this clear figure when they were writing this. The word actually had a broad semantic range and was able to do more than just point to the singular understanding of Messiah that we have through Christ. Does that make sense? So myth number one, oh, there's just tons of all these Old Testament texts that are all clamoring for a messianic figure. That's overstated. From this perspective, I need to keep saying that because actually, once we get down here, I would say, I totally disagree. I think actually every single text of the Old Testament, ones that we don't even see, are actually clamoring for Messiah. But it's because we're looking at this level, which would be more the body level of the text as opposed to the spirit of the text. Okay, we'll get there. But first level, first myth, majority of the Old Testament texts point to a messianic figure. From a first level perspective, that's not true. Number two, there is also the myth that people were looking around every corner and under every rock for the Messiah. Now, that's more of a first century observation. We assume that by the first century, everybody's looking for this messianic figure. No, what you're going to see is there is a convoluted understanding of what's going to happen. Now, you will see that people are expecting God to intervene. That is true. But you see them at times having God intervene, but not even using a messianic figure. Doing it some way completely different. So one of the things that we need to understand is that there was not a monolithic, a uniform way of understanding how God's intervention would occur. In the first century, people weren't going, okay, we just got to find the Messiah. When we find him, then we're all good. Some people would be going, we don't even know if there's going to be a Messiah. Because God may choose to intervene in a different way. That'll become more clear once we start diving into the actual texts. Myth number three at the very beginning. The Messiah was seen by the Jews as a quasi-divine God incarnate figure. That is not true. As a matter of fact, that is one of the major contributions that Jesus was giving to the understanding of Messiah, is that he is fully human, but also fully divine. And that was not in their understanding. As a matter of fact, N.T. Wright in his book, Jesus and the Victory of God, says, "The word Messiah within Jesus' world does not refer in itself to a divine or quasi-divine figure. There are puzzling and opaque texts in the Hebrew scriptures which speak of the king as one speaks of God, Israel's God, like Psalm 45. There are passages where the roles of Yahweh and of the king seem to be intertwined, like Ezekiel 34. But there is no evidence to suggest that the various messianic and quasi-messianic figures who flit through the pages of first century history thought of themselves or were thought by others in this divine fashion." So at the very outset, we need to understand there was not a clear understanding. If there was a messianic figure in their mind, there was nobody saying, and whenever that messianic figure, they are also going to be God in the flesh. There was no one really saying that. Okay? That would have been a major hurdle for a monotheistic Jewish believer to actually overcome. Make sense? Even, frankly, a Greek believer. Anyway.
You may get to this later, but there still was the understanding, though, with this messianic expectation, an everlasting kingdom, right? That would come through.
Keep talking to me.
Okay, so they're not expecting an everlasting person, but were they expecting an everlasting kingdom through this messianic expectation?
Yes, and I'm hesitating because it doesn't need to go through the Messiah, a messianic figure, in order for there to be an everlasting kingdom. In other words, David's throne, yes, after the exile, it would be restored and God's presence would be restored to Israel, but that could also come through a Hasmonean dynasty type. It doesn't necessarily need to be an everlasting, never-dying figure. That would not have been something that would have been, frankly, on their radar. That actually expects too much out of Jewish eschatology than what it could actually bear. There's no evidence that they had an everlasting figure, even though there was an everlasting throne. Why? Because you are the seed of Abraham, therefore the promise of Abraham is everlasting in as much as the people exist. Like, you are, if you're David's son, you are, by extension, David. And this even goes through the difference between even understanding. We are so individualistic. And I'm not even saying that necessarily as a negative. I'm just saying that it's a difference. That we see a major divorce between us and our parents. I'm not my parents. That's our assumption. That's our default. That's where we begin. That's not where the ancient world or communal societies begin. They begin with the default, I am my parents. I am my grandparents. I am my, and they trace their genealogies back. And they are a real extension. So there's even even in the Old Testament, I can't remember the exact reference, but there's even the discussion of, because this person would later impregnate a woman with their seed, then the person that they impregnate them with actually was present during this moment, even though at that moment there was not even conception. Why? Because they are an extension of this person. They are, in a very real sense, that person. Therefore, David's throne, everlasting, doesn't need an everlasting, immortal person. It just needs somebody that's passing down their lineage through that, which is why Matthew 1 is so important, to show that Jesus is of the divinic lineage. Everlasting, because it comes from David's seed. Does that make sense? So even that word, it's actually pretty fascinating whenever you realize that the word everlasting, and the way in which we envision it throughout the Bible, doesn't always mean everlasting in the way in we envision it. And you have to understand that sometimes the word means forever. The word used forever doesn't always mean forever in the way we understand forever. And so it's allowing context or allowing their culture to express what it is trying to express. Does that make sense? Other questions? Oh, cosmology, you always find a way into conversations. Okay, if you don't understand what I mean, don't worry about it. Okay, myth number 4. There is a clear consensus, this is a myth, on the picture and person of the Messiah. If there is a Messiah, one of the things we assume is everybody's looking for the same thing. No, they weren't. We'll actually look in the text where they're confused. Because we'll have one group that's looking at Jesus going, hey, we know exactly, or where'd this guy even come from? And then the other group comes along and they say, no, we know where he comes from. And you're going like, okay, now which one is that evidence for or evidence against? So for example, there's one old group that thinks when the Messiah comes, you will have no idea where the person's come from because they've come straight from heaven. But then King Herod hears that the messianic figure could be born in Israel, and he asks his wise leaders, hey, where's the Messiah supposed to be born? And they have an answer. Bethlehem, they say. So which is it? Should we not know where he's from, or should we know exactly where to find him? Even when it comes to what the Messiah is supposed to do, there are general categories, but exactly what you are looking for if there is a Messiah figure is highly debated. And you will see that at times even explode in the Messianic text, especially in the Gospel of John. But we'll get there in due time. So at the very beginning, those are the four myths I'm wanting to say at the outset. Those four on this level, those four are just not true on this level. Okay? Do those all four seem like, oh, that makes total sense? Or to any of those four, you're going, yeah, I don't know that I would have agreed with that. I'm not saying, do you disagree with me? You understand? Are those familiar to you? Does that make sense to you? Or are you guys all going like, yeah, I think I would have thought different. I'm just wanting to gauge the room. So this is where you give me feedback. Does that make sense? Yes.
May be a little bit different than like looking around every corner for the Messiah, but like, I don't know, I've always heard that they were kind of always praying and anticipating and expecting that. How does that, those two go together?
Yeah, in the nuance that I emphasize is they were expecting God to move or to intervene. But where the part of the myth that I'm attacking there is, God to intervene, we'll see this, does not necessitate a Messiah. They're looking for God to intervene. Now, at times, it is very clearly through a Messiah. So we'll even look at that actually isn't clear. At times, it is very clearly through a Messiah. At other times, like for example, in the Qumran, we literally have God's intervention depicted as a messianic figure, as multiple messianic figures, and as no messianic figures in the same community. You have three different options. No Messiah, one Messiah, multiple. To accomplish God's intervention. So they were fervently praying and looking for God's intervention. But it does not necessitate that the entire, especially all of Israel, was looking for a Messiah. Now some may have been. So you even see it at the beginning of Luke's gospel. Is it Zechariah who is fervently praying for a Messiah? The Messiah has come. He may have been a part of a tradition or believed that a Messiah was coming. But what you're going to see is throughout the Jewish literature, especially we're going to be relying heavily on the Dead Sea Scrolls, Pseudepigrapha, Apocrypha. You're going to see a convoluted answer to the question: when and how will God intervene? Very, very diverse. Good. I mean, but that's important to understand what it is you thought you knew and what it is that's being said, and even allowing some of that tension and friction to exist. That's okay. That's important. Because otherwise, if you don't know where it is that you disagree, then you may not even know where we're going. Any other questions about that or comments? Yeah. Oh, that was a half hand. Sorry, you can take it back if you want.
I'm not sure whether or not it's relevant enough.
Okay. How so? I mean, if you attach it to Revelation, you know that's my heart, so.
Yeah.
Yes, but go ahead.
Well, the way that it's often dealt with in the Christian church can be sometimes convoluted, especially when it gets to eschatology and stuff.
So, oh, okay, yeah. I can see that.
Is that kind of similar, or is it?
No, it definitely would be similar. And I think that, part of the reality is that we are dealing with mystery, and I think appropriately so. This is why I think Paul was so astounded when he talks about the mystery of God revealed in Christ. And we struggle with mystery. We don't really know what to do with mystery. A lot of times mystery, instead of drawing us closer to God, it seems to repel us or to make us just go absolutely nuts. It reminds me, because as you say that, I'm kind of even thinking back over. I mean, I'm pretty forceful on my position on the book of Revelation, but if I'm not right, I won't be disappointed. You know, one of my mentors once told me, he said, Shane, if you write a book and you're never willing to write another book right after it that says, basically, everything I said in the previous book was wrong, then don't ever write. Because if you are locking yourself into a position where you're never allowed to change anything that you think, then you've actually imprisoned yourself in something that's far more damaging than never writing. So I think we need to, it is parallel, and I think that that's why a lot of this takes distinct humility. I mean, do not hear me over the next couple class periods as we're going through this trashing on the Jews. Because that's an unfair characterization. I mean, it's not as if they knew nothing, I just don't think that they knew everything that they had. And so sometimes they cast aside a piece of the puzzle thinking it went to another puzzle, when in reality it was one of the cornerstones. There you go. There's a biblical metaphor for you. Of the puzzle. But we do that too. We do that even on just basic levels, not even just stuff like second coming. So I think it's an appropriate parallel. One that actually appreciates the tension of what it is we're dealing with. Other thoughts, questions? Here we go. Okay, we're going to look at the pre-Jewish monarchy first. So I'm going to segment this out similar to how we looked at the exile, but it will be segmented differently. Because I'm not saying pre-exile, I'm saying pre-Jewish monarchy. That's a little different. So it takes the pre-exilic period and it kind of cuts it in, well, really two-third, one-third. Okay? So pre-Jewish monarchy, before there is a quote-unquote king on the throne. And I'm using that quote-unquote because of 1 Samuel 8. What you have is, whenever it comes to messianic language, from this perspective, these messianic texts, like we have a couple, like for example, Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, and I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers. Where is the messianic expectation? The next line, right? He will crush your head and you will strike his heel. That actually is something that's looked at by the early church as one of the earliest, if not the first, messianic prophecy. However, that's this level. That's this level, not this level. In other words, this is a retrospective messianic expectation, or a retrospective, a looking back on messianic understanding. That's not the first level. When this is first written, this isn't talking about a Messiah. It's talking about what is occurring at the fall and the consequences thereof. It's different. So, a lot of the Jewish monarchy, quote-unquote, messianic texts are retrospective. Not a lot of. They are retrospective. You have to look back on and say, from the messianic perspective, we can look back and, I think, appropriately see Christ in texts like this. However, that's not this level. We see a major shift and actually a significant increase in even retrospective texts once we have the monarchy established, once we go through this text. We've already read it once, so I'm not going to read it all again. This is the text, though, where Samuel, growing old, and his sons are starting to reign, and they are perverting the justice and accepting bribes, and the elders come and they say, we want a king. We want to be like the other nations. And then Samuel has a discussion with God. God says, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me as their king, as their leader. Go tell them everything that's going to happen. He does. And what do they do? What's the response after Samuel goes and says, I'm telling you, the kings are going to take your daughters and your sons and your land and your resources. He's going to use them for his wars and his agendas. What do they still do? We want a king. We want to be like the other nations. Give us a king. What's fascinating is it is after this rebellion that you see even an increase in the retrospective messianic texts. I mean, we have some sprinkled throughout the pre-Jewish monarchy period, but there is a surge, an increase in retrospective messianic texts after the kingdom is, or after the request of the king, which I think says something about what it is that the Messiah's role will be. If there is a Messiah, part of the Messiah's role will be to restore rebellion. I intentionally put Genesis 3 next to 1 Samuel 8 because I think we should read them in connection. They are significant moves away from God. Genesis 3, we all see that. But 1 Samuel 8 is a move away from God. And the further you move away from God, the more important or the more clear the role of the Messiah becomes. The role of the Messiah is to restore what was rejected or lost. I actually don't even like the word lost because it almost seems like, oh, I lost my keys. I can't find them. No. That's not what's happening in Genesis 3, and that's not what's happening in 1 Samuel 8. They are rejecting. And what is being rejected, the Messiah will come and restore. Therefore, it doesn't surprise me that once we move past the monarchy being established, once we move into the monarchy period, we see an increase in retrospective messianic texts. Why do I keep saying retrospective? Why is that word so important? Yes, because it's clarifying what we're talking about. It's an increase in retrospective messianic texts, level 3. But not necessarily, well, not level 1, and not even necessarily level 2. The messianic texts become messianic looking back on or guessing at, but not at the time of it being written. So, for example, let's go into the Jewish monarchy, and let's read one of the big messianic texts. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be a father to him, and he shall be my son. Your throne, talking to David, shall be established forever. We read that, and we're seeing the word forever, and we're thinking divine son of God. It's not what David would have been thinking of. That's not what would have been talked about here. This, as well, is a retrospective messianic text, a text from the first level. We look back on and see the Messiah. But as it is being written, that is not what they're thinking. They're not thinking, well, whenever this all, you know, just absolutely gets ripped in two with the exile, good thing there's a quasi-divine messianic figure that's going to come and set it all right. That's not what's happening when this text is being celebrated. Does that make sense? Why this distinction is so important? Why are we talking about this? Why am I going to spend all this time about understanding these levels of interpretation and how these texts were originally received and how they eventually... Why am I taking this time to parcel this out? What? It's the story before the story. If you're really going to be able to put yourself into the gospel narrative, into the audience when Jesus is preaching a sermon on the kingdom... If you're going to be able to see through the eyes of the Pharisees or the Sadducees as they are looking at John the Baptist out in the wilderness, you're going to need to know not just what they knew, but what was confusing. You have to know what was on the table. And one of the things I think that we will be overwhelmed by is the convoluted reality of what it was, how it was that God was going to intervene. So that you don't just get to blame them and be like, man, how could they not understand Jesus was the Messiah? My goodness, these people were so dumb. I mean, he's doing miracles. So? Even Egyptians, you know, the Egyptian sorcerers at the time of the Exodus could do miracles. So? Well, but I mean, you know, I mean, he's speaking with that one with authority like we've never seen before. Okay. So did Socrates. So, no, I mean, you have to understand that to identify Jesus actually, once you have the expectations in place, is even harder to see him as the Messiah than it is easier given what he comes and gives. Because their expectations are not lining up with his proclamation. It just doesn't. Even if they were looking for a Messiah, that's what's going to be crazy. Even if they were looking for a Messiah, Jesus probably wouldn't have been their number one candidate once you see all their expectations played out. So the idea of missing him in the first century becomes a lot more easy to understand when you realize the story before the story, when you realize the expectations of the Messiah or lack thereof. Okay? So we're in the Jewish monarchy. We see an increase in retrospective messianic texts. 2 Samuel 7, 1 Samuel 23, the Psalms. I mean, when we go to the Psalms, it's like this hotbed of messianic prophetic literature. Not when it was originally written. Like Psalm chapter 2, even though it is, my goodness, I mean, even once we're in the intertestamental period, they look back at Psalm 2 and say, oh, that's a messianic text. But when it was originally written, it was been written to a king. It's one of the things I love about this third level, is I can appreciate what it was that's happening in the Psalms. In the Psalms, they are exaggerating and lavishing these over-the-top adulation, over-the-top adoration towards their kings. And yet when Christ comes, their greatest exaggerations don't even match who he is. They are gathering as much language and as much grandeur as they can to talk about their kings. And yet when Christ comes, it's like, yeah, I mean, that comes close, but it still falls woefully short. Because our greatest exaggeration cannot contain the limitless reality of the glory of Christ. The Psalms, though, become a hotbed for third-level interpretations of the Messiah because of their grandeur nature, their nature of exaggeration, their poetic language. But when they were originally written, a lot of times they were like, you know, it was several of them, especially the regal ones, you know, it's like a coronation festival. The king's coming and you write a song and you sing it for him. And then later on, it's like, actually, that fits with who Christ was. Huh. Let's read it as such. Which I think is the appropriate way to read the Psalms. But I'm a dreamer. Okay. Once we start to move through the Jewish monarchy and we hit the pre-exilic period, so the time period right before the exile and the exile, we see an explosion of not just retrospective messianic texts, although they are that, but of more clear, dead in line, exactly what we're looking for, messianic type texts. Why would that be? Why would it be that right before and during the exile, we see an explosion of texts like this? A shoot coming from the stump of Jesse, Isaiah 11, or Jeremiah 23, 5. The days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I shall raise up for David a righteous branch, and he shall reign as king and deal wisely, and shall execute justice and righteousness in the land. Or Jeremiah 33, thus says the Lord, David shall never lack a man to sit on the throne of the house of Israel. Or Ezekiel 34, 23, I will establish over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he shall feed them and be their shepherd, and I, the Lord, will be their God. Or Ezekiel 37, I will set up over them one shepherd, my servant David. We see a surge of clear texts looking for a figure to reign during the pre-exile exilic period. Why? Yeah, go. Say it again. All of a sudden, their situation is so drastically changed. The need, let me even just rephrase what you said because I think it's dead on. They're craving has changed. When you lose something, a lot of times you realize how much it is that you actually desired it. You know, that's the whole, even the concept of taking something for granted. Usually the taking something for granted is whenever you treat something that is present as if it is not, but then when it is not, you long for it. And there is a surge in the exile in the pre-exilic period that starts to invoke this robust richness of texts that are directly calling or looking for a figure to intervene. Now, it is also, we see at times, even in the prophets, we see at times God intervening without a messianic figure. So don't let me overpaint this. But you start to understand why it is that during this time, messianic texts would become a lot more clarified, a lot more acute, a lot more clear. It's because the need has changed. There's something in them that they have, that they're longing for. Paula Friedrichsen related to what I'm saying. The prophet's invocation of the ultimate Davidic king served to affirm God's general and continuing commitment to Israel and to his covenant promises, which is something right before the exile and during the exile you're going to need to be reminded of. The promises that he will intervene and that they are looking for an intervening figure. Now, it doesn't mean that they are solidifying their messianic expectations, okay? But what it's saying is, I am not shocked that the major surge of even retrospective messianic texts, but also some that you're going, I don't know how retrospective that is. They seem to be looking for someone. It doesn't surprise me that's right before or during the exile, because the setting has changed. Their longing has changed, and what they're looking for becomes more clear. Does that make sense? So in a sense, what we're doing is, and whenever you use this word, you're taking a gamble because of our Bible beltness, but we're looking at the evolution of messianic thinking, the evolution of messianic understanding is what we're really tracing from the first level perspective. Because I truly would argue here that actually it's been the understanding all the time. It's just what Paul refers to as mystery. We just didn't see it. We didn't have the Christological lens to see it revealed. So during this exilic, pre-exilic period, there are four categories, and this comes from N.T. Wright's JVG, four categories that you see starting to emerge as Jewish expectations of God's restoration. Jewish expectations of God's restoration. Number one, return from exile. You guys see that on your handout. The Jews were expecting that the dispersion that has occurred will be undone. And we've gone through the history. There were quite a few times that we talked about mass deportations, even bringing in people outside and, you know, kind of doing a whole, you know, church plant thing. We're going to take like 400 people from this church and bring them over here. And you see that happening even at times with, somebody's getting pulled over. That's a bummer. You can look. It's okay. And we're back. But messianic expectations, you see the return of exile, that must be a part of it. If there is a Messiah, they better return the exile. Why? Because the promised land had been lost. They need to end what is the antithesis of the Exodus. Remember us talking about that. The exile was the very opposite of the Exodus. Therefore, if we're going to have a messianic figure or a prophet like Moses, which is also a retrospective messianic text, then we are going to, on some level, need a return, an undoing of what it was that was lost, a restoration of the fortunes of the people of God. So the return of exile. Number two, they were expecting the defeat of their enemy. I mean, what is the Exodus motif if it isn't the destruction of Egypt? And so what is it that would be expected in the first century if God's going to intervene? That Rome's going to get theirs. I mean, it's exactly what happens with the Hasmoneans. I mean, what was the validation of Judas Maccabeus being the savior of the people of Israel? Destroying the Greeks. Fighting against the Seleucids successfully. When God intervenes, yes, we're going to have the return of the exiles, but even implicit in the return of the exiles is taking the exiles away from the ones that have exiled them. Defeating the enemies. That's a major problem when Jesus comes. Major problem for people accepting Jesus is that expectation. They were expecting something different. They weren't expecting him to go around healing Roman centurion servants. Not if you're the Messiah. Not if God is truly intervening. Sure, not going to receive well the proclamation of the destruction of the temple, but not the proclamation of the destruction of Rome. That's not going to go over well. Why? Because it's very clear at this point that one of the expectations that God's intervention, if there is a Messiah, he must meet the defeat of the evil, the destruction of their enemies. Number three, the Messiah figure, or the Jewish expectation of restoration, must include the return or the reign of Yahweh at Zion. And you see this in some of our texts that we're in the prophetic, you know, exilic, pre-exilic period. Isaiah 33, "For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king. It is he who will save us." You see their expectation. He will be the one that reigns. In other words, a pre-1 Samuel 8 type understanding. That Yahweh will reign from Zion. Did you have a question?
I totally missed it. I was thinking.
You're fine.
But it was on the defeat of evil. How well developed was their understanding that like sin and death and Satan was their actual enemy as opposed to, you know, the people who were ruling over them? Was that way too close for them to understand?
It was developing. But even at the point of it, let's just say like that they had a Satan. I mean, because you have Beliar. You have Azazel. I mean, you have some names of like a Satan-type figure, Beelzebul. You have some Satan-like figures referred to even in the intertestamental period. Once Jesus comes in the first century, it is more developed. However, now they understood the concept of sin, that i.e. separation from them and God. But they had a system to deal with sin. And their understanding of the enemy was a problem, but nevertheless, they would still not see a great distinction between killing that person and that actually affecting this enemy. So this is the strategy. If this is the person, this is Rome, and there is an enemy over here, you don't like either one of them. But kill this one and it affects that one. What Christ reveals is actually when you kill this one, he just grabs another one. So you've actually never done anything to the enemy. You're going to be perpetuating the enemy until you destroy this one. This can be undone. Now, here's the problem. Let's say they even got that. How do you destroy this one? You see their problem? So even if they had a robust Satanology, they wouldn't know how to deal with the issue. The problem is still persistent.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, because in Isaiah 29, it talks about how God's going to wipe away death forever. So I didn't know how much they understood that death was their real enemy. You
know what I mean? They know that death is a limitation, but not in the way in which we understand death to be our real enemy. I could not say that they had understood that. All right, I think that's time, right? I don't have my watch, but I'm assuming it is. All right, love you guys. See you in the morning.